My experience with wok cooking was mainly through, I think, what a lot of people hear, unless you're from China, your experience was, which was through Chinese restaurants.
That's Kenji Lopez-Ault. You know him from his time writing the Food Lab column at Serious Eats and for his contributions to Special Sauce. Of course, you also know Kenji for his first cookbook, The Food Lab, Better Home Cooking Through Science, which won a James Beard Award. He also wrote a children's book, Every Night is Pizza Night, with the illustrator Gianna Ruggiero. These days, he writes a column for the New York Times and creates videos for Kenji's cooking show, his YouTube channel, which has more than 1 million subscribers. But this week, right now, in fact, we're talking about Kenji's new book, The Wok, Recipes and Techniques, which became a number one New York Times bestseller the first week it was out.
I got my first wok when I was in college at the Target in Somerville for like $30. And so like the two pans I owned were that wok and the Le Creuset Dutch oven that my mom bought me for my birthday 1 year.
This is Special Sauce with Ed Levine, the podcast about food and life, which many people, including me, think are the same thing. I'm your host, Serious Eats founder Ed Levine. Every episode, we talk to some of the leading lights of world culture, food folks and non-food folks alike. You'll hear compelling personal stories about success and failure and how people come up with and use their special sauce to navigate their way through life. Today's show was recorded at the Bell House in Brooklyn, New York. Our first ever live or live-to-tape episode of Special Sauce. And it's only fitting for our first live episode that I'm joined by the inimitable J. Kenji Lopez-Ault, who worked with me side-by-side on Serious Eats from 2009 to 2017 and on Special Sauce since the podcast began in 2015. That's 13 years, dude, and we still like to hang out. I asked Kenji how his life has changed since he wrote The Food Lab.
You won't want to admit this, but I'm sure you've been recognized numerous times since you've been in New York.
A couple times, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Is it uncomfortable? Have you reached a point where this was fun for a while? How do you make sure that you stay with your feet firmly planted on the ground?
I have a family and I got kids and I spend most of my time with my kids and I work and try and feel like I'm just a guy, which everyone is, right? Not everyone's just a guy. We got guys and gals and non-binary pals. I was very lucky and I got very lucky in my career and I was lucky enough to have a book that is selling well and a second book that will hopefully sell well. But it's like I could keep pushing and pushing and pushing and like want to win at everything. But why would I spend more time doing things just to like gain some kind of popularity or gain a little bit more of a career advantage when I'm like, I'm doing fine. Yeah. I don't have to worry about that. I can spend time focusing on the things that I want to focus on.
And what you're saying is that, you know what? I'm good. You know, like I have to work at it. It's different, you know, because I think when we first met each other, we were both pretty focused, you know, and working really, really hard.
And we were both about the same age at the time.
Exactly. It's really your family. And is it really the natural evolution of someone's work life, right? If they're lucky, right? Which is they get to decide what they want to do with their day. You know, which is a luxury for many people.
Oh, I mean, yeah, I mean, it's insanely lucky. And, you know, and for me, it's also like, I can't understand people who like seem to have enough, but want more. it's like I understand it because when I was younger, I was super competitive and I wanted to be the best at everything. And
even though he doesn't know anything about sports and doesn't play any sports, he is super competitive.
I was. And I felt like, I'm always going to want to do this. Like my goal is to be famous and successful, whatever. Like I want to be the best at whatever I do. And at this point it's like, I think it's one of those things that comes from getting married and having kids and resetting priorities. And then also really being forced to stop and think about like, is what you're doing like actually making you happy? Or are you only doing it because you have this like impulse to win or whatever, right? Like, is it making you happy to win at this? Like, what's it worth?
I've watched you deal with social media and the way you've dealt with it has evolved over the years, right? It's a good thing. But, you know, you're not on Twitter anymore. And we talked about this, and I listened to another interview you did the other day, and you said something that was really telling, I thought, which is, why would I want to continue doing something that brings out the worst in me? You know, and I think that it's not just, it's a universal about a Twitter, right? It's really hard not to react viscerally.
Yeah. It's hard not to react viscerally, but it's also, yeah, the platform is like the voices that come through. It's like if you were in a room full of people talking, and you heard someone mention something about you, and you're like, oh, I kind of disagree with that. It's okay. Well, that's relatively easy to ignore because it's like, oh, it's just this one voice from far away. But on like these social media platforms, like the one voice that all voices are the same distance, right? And so like the ones that get to you most, even if it's like someone's like, why are you even responding? Why do you care about this person's opinion? You don't know them. You're never going to meet them. They're never going to come into your sphere. Who cares? It's very easy for that voice to like,
yes, because
stick in
every
front of you.
Voice is the same volume on Twitter.
Right, right. And so, you know, so it's like in an ideal world, I would like to be able to say I'm zen enough to like be able to filter that stuff out, but I'm not, right? And so instead, it's just like it's much easier just to shut it off.
More of my conversation with Kenji after this quick break. And if you want more special sauce in your life, just subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts. Or go to thespecialsaucepodcast.com where you'll find every episode we've ever done.
So how did the Wok book come about? You know, and a related question is, like, when did you fall in love with wok cooking?
Well, the Wok book came about, it was a chapter of my first book. You know, I did a lot of wok content on Serious Eats, and I've been cooking in a wok for years.
But never cooked professionally with a wok, right?
I never worked in like any kind of East Asian restaurant.
I'm sure most of you know Kenji worked in really serious Boston restaurants.
And some not so serious, yeah.
And some not so serious. He did work in a Mongolian barbecue place. That was his first gig.
Yeah.
What was that called?
Fire and Ice.
Yeah. Fire and Ice.
I was hired as a prep cook, and a week later, I was promoted to Knight of the Round Grill.
Yeah. See, like, we're all in the presence of a Knight of the Round Grill. Okay, so what fascinated you about wok cooking?
Well, okay, so my mom's in the house tonight, so I'm not going to tell the normal sort of half made up story about how I grew up at my mother's knee and she cooked in her wok. I don't tell that story. My mom had I knew it growing up vaguely, right? Like my mom had a wok that she would deep fry in, and so she would make.
Your
like,
mom came from Japan and, mm-hmm. as a teenager.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And she wants me to clarify that in some article it said that her parents followed her here. In fact, they came here, I think, despite the fact that she wants to clarify that.
All right. Thank you, Mom.
So she would deep fry gyoza, things like that. She would make korokke, like Japanese korokke. All these recipes are in the book. But my experience with wok cooking was mainly through, I think, what a lot of people hear, unless you're from China, your experience was, which was through Chinese restaurants. And, my dad was particularly kind of obsessed with Chinese restaurants. So he would take us around to Chinese restaurants. And so that was my experience growing up, was eating mainly Japanese home cooking, wok-wise, that is, Japanese home cooking and Chinese American food. And, you know, particularly like at the time when I was growing up in New York and Boston, and New York in the 80s was like, mainly sort of Southern Chinese, mm-hmm. Cantonese-influenced stuff, as opposed to now, where there's like a huge array of regional Chinese cuisines. But I got my first wok when I was in college at the Target in Somerville for like $30. And so like the two pans I owned were that wok and a Le Creuset Dutch oven that my mom bought me for my birthday 1 year. But that wok is the same wok that I have now. And if in the book, it's like every single photo in the book is wow. done in that same wok. It was a $30 carbon steel, 14 inch flat bottom wok, which just coincidentally happens to also be the kind of wok I recommend. And I do mean coincidentally, that is the best kind of wok to have. I just got lucky that I found
How come
that one
we don't have an opportunity to buy the Kenji Lopez Alt autograph model wok?
Because I don't do sponsorships or partnerships.
Yeah, Kenji's a purist.
But yeah, so that wok, I had it in college, and I cooked for friends with it in college, and I cooked when I was living with roommates, and I cooked when I was, just married to Audrey. We were living in Harlem in like a galley kitchen in Harlem, and then now I cook for it when we moved to California. Now we have two kids, and I cook for all of it. It's an extraordinarily versatile, useful tool that you can do a huge range of things, and then it's particularly good for for quick things. It's like I sometimes like project recipes, and my first book was all project recipes, but I've never made the same meatloaf that I wrote in that book, right? It was just to illustrate things. It wasn't practical. I hope none of you have actually made it. But
that was like the Woodstock of meatloaf recipes. It was like 3 days.
Long, 4 days long and ends in fire.
Yeah, yeah.
But this book, the wok is a much more, so first of all, personal to me because I use it at 3 to 5 times a week. It's always on my stovetop. And more practical than the first book. So it's aimed much more at it comes from more of the perspective of someone with a family and kids as opposed to, someone whose only job is to spend 40 hours boiling eggs.
You say at the end of the introduction that when it comes to producing quick, flavorful, and versatile meals, the wok beats every other pan in the kitchen, hands down. And did you think that before you embarked on the book, or did you discover that?
No, I mean, that's why I started writing the book. So I think I actually wrote that. That was something that was in the first food lab. So the food lab, it was a much longer book. We cut out basically everything that wasn't American or very sort of American adjacent. Other than in the chapter about what pots and pans you should have, there's this 2-page long thing about woks. And then there's no wok recipes in the book. And that was because we cut the wok chapter and forgot to cut that bit. Or maybe I felt that was too important. I felt someday I'm going to write a wok book and I hope everyone already has a wok. But then when we started writing the second book and Melanie was, very gently and politely pressuring me to write another cookbook, I was having trouble sort of figuring out what it was going to be. And so I started writing the wok chapter I was a few hundred pages in and writing the outline and figuring out what recipes. And it was one of those things where it's like, all right, well, if we're going to learn about Szechuan peppercorns for this one recipe, well, now we have to write this sidebar about Szechuan peppercorns. And now why wouldn't we write 6 more recipes for it? And so it's this thing that grows and grows. And so we were a couple hundred pages in and I called Melanie and said, hey, let's write a wok book.
And what she was say.
She was immediately on board and supportive. She's a great editor.
I think what's interesting to note here is that the first book is 900 pages. And I would say that Kenji has some issues with limits. Because...
My mom would agree.
Because, think about this. So the book was already... 900 page ended up being 900 pages, and you probably handed in another 40,000 words.
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, another several hundred pages. Yeah, I mean, it was 2 volumes. Yeah, it was,
right.
I think it was. Yeah.
This reminds me of many, many times in the Serious Eats offices when, one of the editors would come to me and say, "Can't you just hand it in 50,000 words about?" Why pepperoni curls? What should we do with that? But we made it work, 15,000 words on chocolate chip cookies.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the good thing about online writing is there's no, you don't have to pay for the paper. Yeah.
Exactly. Before we get into more of the specifics of the wok, I noticed I've now read the book pretty carefully, that in a way, The Wok represents your evolution, not just as a writer, as a cook, as a recipe developer, but also as a human being. You know, it's like, because we've known each other so long, it's like the Kenji that is on this earth in 2022 is very different than the Kenji that wrote The Food Lab. Like, go into a little bit of what you think the differences are as you've evolved as a person.
I mean, I think a lot of it, from a like a professional perspective, is that you know, like when the first book came out, and you know, when we were writing on Serious Eats, especially, like we were writing online, and there's like this pressure for page views and whatever, you know, there's all this, it's competitive, right? And so it's like everything has to be the best. We have to like brainstorm all these like what's going to go viral, what can we do? It's like, and so you're playing this game, and I feel like, at least at the time, and especially like with what happened with the way what with my book, when my book came out and the way it was received, was that I just noticed a lot of like sort of negativity coming with the negativity that comes with competitiveness, and the negativity that comes with like ideas of what's best and what's perfect and what's blah blah blah, you know. And
we always used to say, because everyone orthodox thinking when it came to the web was you always titled something the best pepperoni curls.
Right. Well, no, you know what? One of the first people that put this idea, you know, that made me start stopping to think about this was Carrie Jones, who was our colleague and one of the managing editors at Serious Eats. She was always an advocate of saying, instead of the best sandwiches in New York, we should call it five really good sandwiches in New York, or whatever, you know, whatever really good things, because it's like, you know, there's this impulse to say best because of SEO and whatever, because people want the best. But it's like, first of all, it's like, what are you judging it on? Who are you to decide what's best and what's not? Are you really trying every single sandwich in New York? And it's like, and on top of that, it's also just like, you know, it's like some days Revolver, some days Rubber Soul. Your opinion changes.
We share a passion for the Beatles.
But I think after my book came out, I also started seeing, you know, like a lot of times I would see pictures that some, you know, someone would try cooking a steak for the first time and would be very happy with the results, as they should be. Whatever the results are, they should be happy because they tried for the first time. And they would post a picture online and they would say, I'm really happy. And then someone would come along and be like, oh, you clearly didn't rest it for 17 minutes or whatever, you know, and just, you know, that kind of thing where it's like, all right, you have this knowledge and now you feel this need to like weaponize it and like, you know, tear someone else down for it. And when I saw things like that, and I saw it especially like on the Serious Eats subreddit or pictures of recipes of mine that people had done, like I always felt responsible. It's like, and that's not how I meant this stuff to be. Like when I said these are the best chocolate chip cookies, I didn't mean like every other chocolate chip cookie sucks.
Right.
Right. And so, you know, and so in that sense, like that's part of what drove me to write the theme of the children's book, you know, which is about Every Night is Pizza Night, which is about understanding and contextualizing what things are important for other people. And so I guess I'm just a lot more sort of cognizant of that. And I think about that a lot more in my writing. And so, you know, I'm lucky to be able to be in this position where I can say, hey, like, it's not that important to be
right.
The best.
It's
not that important
great.
To do this. But at the same time, I understand why people need to
sure.
do it.
It became almost a part of the food culture to have people come up to me or say online, Kenji says. Kenji
right.
says. Like, Kenji says the earth is flat. Okay. And, I mean, that... You must have felt that, because I can't tell you how many conversations I had with people that started that way. You know, whether it came to steak or, you know, even my wife, like, you know. Kenji says you can't salt the pasta water till it's boiling.
Other way around.
See? I still don't get
but
it
who
right.
Who cares, right? Salt it however you want.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Why do you think people are so scared of the wok? Everyone gets the wok because it's on your wedding registry and then you'd never use it. So, like, why are people scared of the wok?
So, well, I don't know if people are scared of it, but I think people have this misconception that, especially people like me who grew up in the West, who your perception of, and my perception was of the wok was that it's a dish that you use to cook in Chinese restaurants over big flames. And so the fact that like I was kind of exposed to a lot of this Southern Chinese restaurant style cuisine, and that was sort of my experience of most of the wok, where it's all stir fries and all really high heat. And, I mean, not everything, but a lot of it is. It made me think for a long time, oh, like I can't stir fry. If you look at like my early wok stuff on Serious Eats, which I think is now getting all replaced with new wok stuff, with a new guide that's coming out soon. But if you look at the early wok stuff in the next 2 weeks, we wrote a lot about how like you need this like big flame. You hear the ways to like capture these flavors. But in reality, like that's just like a teeny percentage of what wok cooking is. And there's really, you know, there's hundreds of millions of people every day who cook in a wok that don't have restaurant style burners at home. So I think that's part of what it is. And I see that online also. It's like, should I get a wok? And then like people will jump on the comments and be like, no, it's like not worth getting a wok unless you can get 150,000 BTU burner. I mean, we're going to cook in a wok in a, it's an 1800 watt electric induction cooktop. And I looked up the math and that's like 6,800 BTU, I think, something like that. It's like less than your average home burner, right, as far as heat output goes. And we're going to do fine, I think.
You said in another interview that the burners in Chinese restaurants are literally what, 10 times as powerful as
they get to, like, I mean, they can't, so depending on the type of restaurant, the specific cuisine, but yeah, like if you're at a restaurant that specializes in Cantonese, like if you're getting like dry fried beef chow fun with that nice smoky flavor, as my dad called it, like those, they're probably cooking on like 150,000 BTU per hour burners, so more than 20 times the strength of this.
One of the many things I love about the book is your attitude about authenticity. So I wonder if you would share your take on authenticity, and has that changed?
It was mainly, you know, thinking about like the non-Japanese and the non sort of Asian American portions of it, you know, so which is a lot of it, which is a lot of like Chinese, Thai, Vietnamese, like here are these cuisines that I am like a visitor to, you know, why am I writing about this? And, you know, so my overall perspective on that has been like, well, all right, I started cooking with a wok when I was around 20 years old. I've been cooking with it for 20 years. I have this particular experience to me of growing up in a, you know, Japanese American house and eating a lot of Chinese food with my dad when I was growing up. And so these are experiences that are sort of unique to me, but I also think a lot of my audience can probably relate to those experiences. And just as a person who cooks for friends and family and stuff, like these are the ways that I've found a wok helpful. And this is what I've discovered in as far as research goes, reading other people's work. So I think for me, it's like, if it's useful to me in this way, it can be useful to other people in that way. If you want, like, of course, like a guide to specific regional Chinese cuisines or specific Thai cuisines or something that goes deeper into the history and cultural aspects of it. I mean, I touch on it a little bit, but I tried very hard to frame it in terms of my experience and how my experience might parallel something that you would find useful in your life. And then as far as like sort of the history and the cultural elements go, I spent a lot more time on this book, you know, doing more journalism, like talking with other writers, reporting, referencing other works, because I felt it was something that I did want to be sensitive to. And so for me, as far as like authenticity goes, like there's a recipe in there called Pico's Not So Bland Chicken, which is, my dad used to make a dish called Pico's Bland Chicken. Pico's my sister. He used to make a dish called Pico's Bland Chicken when she was little because she wouldn't eat anything spicy. And so this is like a dish it's like velveted chicken. It had like mushrooms and carrots, and it was a dish she knew she would like. I remember that, and we talked about it a lot, me and my sister. And I made like a sort of updated version of that for the book. And so to me, that's like a very authentic recipe. That's what I grew up with.
It's true to itself.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not from any particular cuisine other than like, here's a dish that like means something to me. And I find the techniques in it useful. I'm going to show you the techniques, and then you can either make that dish or use those techniques in another way that's meaningful to you.
What's cool also about the book is that you have no compunctions about crediting other people. in the book. You know, no, a lot of cookbook writers are reluctant to do that. And I'm not quite sure why, but you give shout outs to Fuchsia Dunlop and Grace Young and all the great Chinese food writers that have come before you.
You know, I know, like, sometimes it's a matter of real estate space, you know, and it's like, and it's also like a matter of like, you can't always remember where you learn something. You know, some things it's like you've been doing for so long and you just naturally do it, right? And it's like, where did I learn that from? I don't know. And it takes some work to actually think back and try and remember. And my mother will tell you that I'm like, I have a terrible memory. And so half the things I've said about her in the book are not true, but I tried hard and I tried to fact check as far as my family goes. But, I can definitely understand the, why people skip it. And it's not always out of bad intent. I find like the more I reference people, the more people who read your work are able to, you know, explore other things that are particularly interesting to them, the more good spirit you have with other, like there's literally no downside to crediting as much and often as possible, even if it means like cutting out, you know, like when I write for the New York Times now, it's like I try very hard to reference as many sources as I can. And when you have like a 600 word limit, and you have to use like 60 of those words just listing a book, like a bunch of books, that's a significant portion of real estate. But it's like, I find that ends up being more, it supports your work more and it makes your work more credible. And it makes the person reading your work more trust you more than a simple explanation, you know, using those 60 words to explain something would.
Now you mentioned velveting. First of all, I love anything that's called velveting. I just think that's a really cool, like, actually, I have a sore neck. So
would you like me to velvet
it
for you?
I'd like you to velvet my neck. But you talked about velvet. So let's talk about what you mean by velveting.
So you marinate meat typically in it'll usually have like a mixture of egg whites and cornstarch and some kind of alkaline. So egg whites are vaguely alkaline. There are stronger alkaline things that you might marinate in, but that combination of alkalinity and the egg white proteins and the cornstarch, they create this kind of coating, this kind of soft, slippery coating on the surface of meats. And then you pass it through. So it's called passing through. You can do it typically in a restaurant. You would do it through oil. So you would have like either a separate wok with hot oil, or you would fill your wok with oil that you then dump out, and you get the oil really hot. Pass the meat through it. It takes about like 10, 20 seconds of cooking. Then you strain it out. It's sort of a part cooking step. At home, I recommend doing it in water, just doing passing it through in water, which works really well and is a lot easier to deal with than, you know, pouring out and straining oil. But what it does is it part cooks the meat so that when you're then subsequently stir frying it, it doesn't have to spend as long in the wok. And so you don't run the risk of sort of steaming things. So it's already cooked. It makes the stir frying process easier. And it also helps it absorb sort of it gives it a sort of slicker texture. So and as moisture comes out from the meat on the inside, it sort of gets absorbed into this slippery sheath that gives it that really sort of tender, I don't know what the word is, tender texture, you know, that kind of thing.
That's it.
Kenji's fans can learn a lot about what he's up to from his Instagram feed and his YouTube channel. But as someone who has worked closely with him for more than a decade, I knew there had to be things about Kenji's life that he usually keeps to himself.
So I'd like you to tell us a couple of things about yourself that people might not know. And if you don't come up with them, I know a lot. Okay, so give us a couple of things about Kenji that you...
Oh, just random?
Yeah, just random. Just random.
When I was like 7 years old, I would wear my sister's leotard, and I had an alter ego named Lovely Lavender.
I didn't know that. That's good. I thought you might tell them about your experience dealing with Paul McCartney's security detail.
I was coming home from a trip with Audrey, my wife, and my mom. And we were coming from LaGuardia to my mom's place in Morningside Heights, and we were passing by the Apollo. And I saw this big sign that said, like, Paul McCartney playing tonight. This was like late at night in the middle of maybe January. I think we're coming back from Japan. Late at night in the middle of January, freezing cold, like ice on the streets. And so I told my mom, hey, can you drop me off here? And you and Audrey go home and I'll walk back. Because I was like, maybe I'll get a chance to meet Paul McCartney. And so I like waited out in front of the Apollo for a while. The show had ended, like all the crowds were gone and like nobody was coming out. So I was like, all right, like I'll start walking home. And the route that I was taking to get home took me to the street behind the Apollo. Yeah. And so I started walking down the street, and as I'm walking, like halfway down the street, I see like there's police putting up a barricade on the other end of the street. And then I turn around and it's like, oh, there's a police barricade on this end of the street. And then I started noticing like, but everybody's on the other side of the police barricade. And then I saw this door open and Paul McCartney walks out, with his security guards. And somehow I had managed to like slip through right at the time when they like put up these barricades and Paul McCartney was coming out. And my reaction, so I had come out of a cab and I had a pen with me and a winter coat. So when I saw him, my only reaction was like, oh shit, like I gotta act fast. Let's get his autograph. And I started walking towards him and I went like this to grab the pen out of my coat. And then the next thing I know, like I was on the ground. there were like four huge guys. My shirt was ripped open. It's missing a button. I saved the shirt. And I was like, I'm just trying to get an autograph. And then like I look up and Paul McCartney's standing above me. He's like, what's all this about? And I was like, I'm just trying to get an autograph. Now in retrospect, I think probably trying to avoid a lawsuit. He, very helpfully, like he gave me his hand, picked me up, like brushed me off. He's like, you're all right, mate. And he's like, what can I do for you? Like, you want an autograph? And I said, sure. And I wanted to get an autograph for my dad, who's also a huge Paul McCartney fan. So I gave him the pen and I said, can you make it out to Fred Alt? And he's like, what? I was like, can you make it out to Fred Alt? He's like, how about I just write two, leave it blank, and then sign Paul McCartney and you can fill in whatever you want. And so I still have that. And
yeah, that's a pretty good story, isn't it?
That's it for part one of my conversation with J. Kenji Lopez-Alt, author of The Wok, Recipes and Techniques. We recorded the interview at the Bell House in Brooklyn, New York. Join us next week when our audience grills them on some of the finer points of wok cooking and how to get your kids interested in helping out in the kitchen. This episode was produced by Pedro Rafael Rosado and Jocelyn Gonzalez of PRX Productions. Special thanks to the good folks at the Bell House and Josie Smith of Greenlight Bookstore. And if you want more special sauce in your life, just subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts. Or go to thespecialsaucepodcast.com where you'll find every episode we've ever done. I'm Ed Levine, and thanks for listening to Special Sauce. So long, Serious Eaters. See you next time.